Americans Policy Radio, offering a unique perspective on everything. Geopolitics, culture creation, the reality of the world we live in. Coming to you live from New York City, your host, Pierce Redmond.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to another episode of Porkins Policy Radio. As always, I am your host, Pierce Redmond, and you can find this show here at American Freedom Radio, AmericanFreedomRadio.com, as well as on my website, which is PorkinsPolicyReview.com. And you can also hear this rebroadcast later on in the week. You can find this on YouTube and iTunes and on RSS, so lots of different ways to find the show. Very excited about my guest for today. This is a show that I have wanted to do for a while, and I know I think I've talked about it on the show before, and we had some scheduling issues and things, but joining me on the line right now is John Podash, or Podash, right? I'm sorry, John.
Either way is fine.
Oh, okay, cool. And he is the author of The FBI War on Tupac. And very excited to have you on, John. How are you?
Good. Thanks for having me on, Pierce.
Excellent, excellent. Well, John really needs no introduction. I think my listeners, I hope they're all familiar with him. But, John, why don't you just quickly tell us a little bit about yourself and maybe why you decided to write this very fascinating book.
Sure, thanks. Yeah, so the full title of the book is The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. And I subtitled it, I have a long subtitle just so people get a broad understanding of what the whole book's about. It's U.S. intelligence's murderous targeting of Tupac, MLK, Malcolm, Panthers, Hendrix, Marley, rappers, and linked ethnic leftists. And I started working as a drug and alcohol counselor in 1989 in Baltimore City, maybe a year or two out of college. And, in doing that, I just started hearing more and more stories about different things going on in the black community down in Baltimore City. And I would meet other counselors who would kind of give me some books and tell me some more things that were going on. And I happened to be involved in activist stuff on the side and activist work on the side. And so the more I heard about Tupac, the more I realized that I actually started writing a short story, I wanted to do an activist novel about drugs in society at that time. And I made someone who was, I was counseling, who said that her father was a Black Panther killed by the police, one of the characters in my novel. So when I was researching the New York Black Panthers, I learned all about the Shakurs. And so when I saw that he was shot in New York City, in the New York, you know, recording studio lobby, and in the Washington Post said, another strange twist, the same officers that immediately arrived there were the ones that immediately arrived a year before in a whole other part of New York City, for the, you know, sexual abuse charges. I thought, you know, this is, interesting that there's some police foul play around his life when there was so much police foul play I had read about around his, Black Panther, you know, mother and father's lives. His mother, Fannie Shakur, had headed the Harlem Black Panthers at one point. So, I really thought that they might be targeting him like they targeted his parents. So I cold called, Michael Treif Warren and asked him about it. He said yes, and no one's writing about it. And we talked about, you know, reading the same activist magazines at that time. And so he was excited if I would write an article about it for Z Magazine or Covert Action Quarterly or The Progressive, some of the magazines I was reading at that time. Now, so that's how I got into it. When I first tried to publish those articles, the white activist press just couldn't fully contemplate what, you know, what that was all about. Now, I think Covert Action Quarterly actually might have given it more of a chance, but somebody over there was not allowing me to give that article to the top editors, and it was a strange phenomenon, but I'm not sure exactly what, why and what was happening there. But they did accept my article after his death, which had about 50 endnotes documenting my sources. So from about December, when I first tried to publish the article in about January of 1995, until he died, and then I ended up submitting another article in 1997 I did lots of research. I ended up going to grad school to get my master's. And while I was there, I was able to go to the New York libraries where you can look up loads of newspapers all around the country. I was able to go to the courthouses and get court documents. And so I got loads of more information. I got more interviews with more people close to Tupac. So they published my first article about the possible FBI targeting of Tupac and murder of Tupac. And then when I published that, you know, people close to him knew of that magazine, and they were very excited for me to give me more information and for me to turn that article into a book. And so as I was researching, you know, what was, you know, what I call the U.S. intelligence assassination of Tupac Shakur, I found all these tactics and personnel that also overlapped, the great black leaders of the last four decades. You know, the tactics and personnel that targeted Tupac had also targeted many of the top Black Panthers. There was overlap with the way they targeted they murdered Malcolm X, assassinated Malcolm X, and the way they assassinated Martin Luther King, believe it or not. And so, that's why I came to find that the Shakurs offer a window into the hidden history of the great, Black liberation movement and the U.S. intelligence targeting of that movement. And so, that's why it became this huge collage on my cover and, the kind of breadth and the width and scope of the whole book, you know, encompassed like last 40 years of targeting.
And it is quite a collage on the cover. I'm sorry, John, that I got the title wrong. I didn't have the book right in front of me. But you know, you've got Huey Newton, Metula Shakur, Afeni Shakur, Fred Hampton Jr., Jameel Al-Amin, Jimi Hendrix, Mumia Abu-Jamal. I mean, there's a ton of people on the cover. And as you said, it's like a amazing book in the sort of slow burn where you start with the Martin Luther King assassination and you move up and you paint such a dense, complex picture. But also at the end of the day, it's very simple in terms of this concerted effort on behalf of the FBI and the CIA and sort of U.S. intelligence, but also the sort of corporatist side of all of this to stymie and oftentimes assassinate pretty much any black figure of prominence who even shows us the slightest bit of political thinking. And sort of critiquing the world around them. And of course, you use Tupac as this amazing kind of example, and it encapsulates so much about all of this. So, Joe, why don't you give us a little bit of a sense of why Tupac was the focus of so much, almost from the second he started making records. There's a great quote that you have of Tupac where he says, I never had a record until I made a record. Mm-hmm. But from that first record, essentially, they were hounding him pretty much his entire life. So why was Tupac this sort of figure that they felt they had to go after?
Yeah, it's basically because he was adding wealth and fame and influence to what was already his national black activist leadership. What most people don't know about Tupac was that he had headed a group called the New African Panthers, which was active in 8 cities when he was 17 and 18 years old. And so that's amazingly hidden in the press. You know, there's so many articles and so many books and so many movies, and it's barely mentioned in one book and one article from what I know of besides my book, that is. And so, recently, just in the last year, when people have been writing about my book more and interviewing me more, it seems like they had covered that a little bit more. But most people, 99% of the people, I would argue, don't know this about Tupac. And so he grew, he was born into a super black radical leftist family of Black Panthers. And he was raised to be, what his mother Afeni called the Black Prince of the Revolution. And at those times, all the white radicals and black radicals and you know, Latino radicals talked about revolution as in really just changing society for the better, you know, overthrowing this capitalist structure that was ruining people's lives and bombing people all over the world and, you know, and changing it to a better government. Mm-hmm. So when he was, you know, 13 years old, Reverend Herb Daughtry was asking kids what they wanted to be when they grew up. And he said a revolutionary, because that's how he was, you know, that's how he was brought up. He would follow his stepfather, Mutulu Shakur, into his acupuncture clinic at Lincoln Detox in the Bronx and help out there. He would go to activist meetings with Afeni, his mom Afeni, his father Mutulu, his, you know, stepfather Mutulu. And so he was brought up that way. When his mother Afeni used to punish him, she used to make him read the New York Times from cover to cover. And that's part of the reason he was so brilliant and so intellectual. Now, and so by the time he was, and you know, when they moved, his mother moved him from the Bronx area to Baltimore when he was about 13 years old, 13 or 14. And she did that because, you know, she had some family down in Baltimore. And then when she got him down here, she fought for him to get into the Baltimore School for the Arts. And so he had already started in a play, Raisin in the Sun, in the Bronx, or I think it was in Harlem at the time at the Apollo, shown at the Apollo. But then when he came down here, he got into the Baltimore School for the Arts and he was studying acting, he was studying, you know, dance and music and all. And, they, you know, teachers talked to him as like the prodigy of the class. He was just brilliant, incredible actor, the best actor, you know, some people said the best actor they've ever had there. And, he was, voted to, represent the school at, you know, citywide meeting, political meetings. But he was also involved in the New African Panthers at that time. And by the time he turned 17, they elected him their youngest ever leader of the New African Panthers. And that was part of another group called the New African People's Organization that some of his mentors were involved with starting. Watani Tai Himba was a former Black Panther, and Choki Lumumba was the head of it. Watani was the founding national security director. And so they were, you know, that was one generation of Black Panthers and Republic of New Africa activists that started it, and they were, you know, two nationwide groups, of course. Now Mutulu had been part of the co-founding member of the Republic of New Africa before he ended up in prison. But, so New African People's Organization was was an excellent group, community organizing group. Tupac started this new group, the New African Panthers, within them. I mean, he started becoming involved with them and then chaired that group. And they were about the same ages as the Black Panthers when they first started. The New African Panthers. So here's a whole new generation of Panthers coming up. And so while Tupac was heading that group, they then moved from Baltimore, Afeni moved them from Baltimore over to Oakland and into the house of Geronimo Pratt's wife. Geronimo Pratt was head of the Los Angeles Black Panthers and was Tupac's godfather. And Sada Shakur was Tupac's godmother. But so Geronimo was in prison, was framed and imprisoned. And was up there and Afeni was constantly working on Geronimo's, you know, release from prison. But so while they were over there and staying in Geronimo Pratt's wife's house, Tupac was working on Geronimo's release. And Huey Newton happened to be imprisoned, thrown in jail for a small offense and thrown in the same, prison though as Geronimo Pratt. And before that, they had, used all kinds of, FBI counterintelligence program tactics to divide Huey Newton and Geronimo Pratt. Some people say that some of the, infiltrators of the Panthers that were around Huey Newton, you know, caused that division and all kinds of, you know, FBI tactics caused that division. But while they were in prison together, Geronimo Pratt took Huey Newton under his wing and they compared, you know, FBI files, you know, documents that their lawyers had gotten for them and realized what was being done to them. And so Huey Newton started working closely with Geronimo again. And then when they were to let Huey Newton out of jail because he was only in there for a minor offense, he said, "I'm not leaving, you know, this jail until you free Geronimo Pratt." But Geronimo Pratt convinced him to leave anyway and just to work on his behalf on the outside. And so when he got out of prison, he then worked with Tupac. And Tupac said in an article for Vibe magazine, said he was consulting closely with the Minister of Defense of the you know, Black Panthers nationally, and that was Huey Newton's title. So he was consulting with Newton. He was consulting with his godfather Geronimo, and he was, you know, doing some serious work. Now the only reason he left the New African Panthers was because he thought he could get his words out there, his ideas out there better through, yeah.
It looks like my recording might have, I'm sorry, we're good. Sorry about that. We're all good.
No problem. So, the only reason he left New American Panther leadership is he thought he could get his ideas out there more and have more influence through the music world, through the rap world. And so that's when he decided to go on tour with Digital Underground and rap with them a bit. And then after that, he, you know, got his big break with his solo album with Interscope Records. And actually, all the other labels turned him down, but Interscope was kind of the newest major label and decided, well, you know, he sounds great, and we're going to go with him. So.
And again, too, I mean, there's lots of details to all of this that we're not going to be able to cover. So, again, do pick up a copy of The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders for all of that. But so now he's with Digital Underground. He's doing, his fame is sort of rising and increasing. And many, you know, his first two albums, quite political. Lots of messages talking about police corruption and police violence. He calls out Bush and the CIA. He talks about various Black Panthers that have been oppressed and persecuted. And he also, along with all of that, also begins this sort of movement to politicize much of the gang culture.
Right.
The Bloods and the Crips. And this seems to be one of the major sort of factors in the targeting of Tupac.
Yeah.
And also what made him such a dangerous figure. Talk a little bit about that, John.
Right. So this also sadly made him misunderstood because he did start playing a part. He started acting and playing a role. And it was a decision made apparently with his imprisoned stepfather, Matulu Shakur. Now, the Black Panthers were already influencing the Bloods and Crips to call peace truces and, you know, get political. And this was happening throughout California. It started right before the L.A. riots, but it spread throughout California and then started spreading across the country. So Tupac decided that he was going to take on the role as a gangster, and it was called the Thug Life Movement, where he's going to pretend to be this thug and this gangster, which isn't what he really was. He was really an intellectual prodigy. And I mean, he rewrote Shakespeare and directed it, started and produced it, you know, plays when he was still in high school. He was brilliant that way. And so here he was taking on this gangsta persona in order to appeal to gangs and politicize them as part of his Black Panther extended family's, you know, movement to get this, the Bloods and Crips to, call peace truces and come political and all that. And, so that's not who he really was. And that's a shame that people don't remember him the right way as they should. But nonetheless, he still had the politics in his lyrics, but he also had some of the, you know, gang/thug lyrics too. And he still, you know, he talked that way as if he was someone that, you know, a little different than who he really was. So that continued, sadly enough, until his death. So people didn't really know him as they should have for all the brilliance, you know, that they should have known him for. Nonetheless, he still put out, you know, some political lyrics, while also putting out the negative, you know, some of the negative lyrics. And, they were trying to kill him though from day one. As soon as he put out, his first album, Tupacalypse Now, several days after the first MTV video worldwide release of his political song Trapped, police, stopped him for jaywalking supposedly, proceeded to choke him unconscious and bang his head against the curb. Now I showed two other incidents where police killed suspects in their custody through those tactics. Okay. Now the second time I argue that they targeted him, he was going from his movie premiere of Juice to the after party, and there was a drive-by shooting on his limousine. I also show an article that detailed how police were caught in a unmarked car in, you know, plain clothes, trying to kill a suspect in an important police brutality case. And so then there was a third incident in Marin City when there was the 50-year anniversary of the Marin City Music Festival, where it was just basically a town fest. They invited Tupac as the honorary guest, and while he's just signing autographs, someone punches him for no reason, and then people with that person who punched him took out a gun and shot at him. Mm. And he was lucky to escape that, and not get killed, but police watched the whole incident and didn't arrest the people that shot at him, but instead arrested Tupac and his stepbrother, Maurice Mopreme Harding, or Maurice, you know, Mopreme Shakur, he calls himself now. He was Matula Shakur's son by another woman, and he was bodyguarding Tupac. And so that's the first three incidents of, I argue, of U.S. intelligence trying to kill Tupac. Now, then there was a fourth incident where he, you know, and meanwhile, he's still doing all this work, on, you know, under, you know, behind the scenes of getting gang leaders together and picnics and having them shake hands and call truces. And so he's doing good work, and he's a major part of spreading the gang peace truce movement throughout the country. And so then when Tupac was starring in Above the Rim, a strange guy came into his life. Now, Tupac was getting what I called harassment arrests used on him. Now, in the documents stolen from an FBI office in 1971, they found this harassment arrest strategy that was being used against different black activist groups in the 1960s. You know, they were using him against the Panthers and using him against the Revolutionary Action Movement, etc. And so I show the evidence that the same thing was being done against Tupac. He was constantly being arrested for frivolous charges, and it was, you know, taking away all his money. He was having to spend time, you know, in jail or trying to get out of jail or in court. And so he was actually hurting for money despite his success. And so into his life comes a guy named Haitian Jacques Ignant, who was going by a different name, you know, an alias. He called himself Nigel and other names. But this guy said, oh, I can help you out. I can give you nice clothes and jewels. And he got him into all the best clubs in New York City when it was hard even for Tupac to get into those clubs at that time. And so he lavishes him with all kinds of stuff and attention. And, but also, we find out that Haitian Jack Ignant had a mile long rap sheet. Tupac's lawyer, Michael Tarif Warren, had a friend in the probation office and found and got and printed out, Jacques Ignant's rap sheet, and mile long and all the cases dismissed. And Michael Warren said it's a sure sign of a government intelligence agent. And, you know, Warren is a longtime political activist and knows these things. And so meanwhile, Warren was the European spokesperson for Mumia Abu-Jamal. So a lot of these people are connected. A lot of the activists are connected in different ways. So Tupac is in Atlanta, and he's doing a concert. He comes out of the concert. He's driving, you know, away from the concert, and a black man's being beaten by some white guys, and he just rolls down his window and says, hey, what's going on? And all of a sudden, the white guys run to Tupac's car, and according to eyewitnesses, they take their gun, smash his car window, and shoot at him. Tupac merely rolls out the back, you know, misses getting hit, grabs the security guard's gun from behind, then the car behind him, and shoots back in self-defense. And so that's what happened there. And now the gun that these two white guys used was a gun stolen from a police evidence locker. And they call that a throwaway gun, a gun you can put down when you make a illegal, you know, murder shooting. And these were two supposedly off-duty police officers, the Whitwells, okay? And so they were obviously up to something much more serious than just incidental shooting of, you know, the top rapper. So that's just like, you know, murder attempt number four, you can say. And so Tupac actually hits these police officers running away with their gun pointed behind them in the butt in the back. But the trial doesn't even go all the way. They just drop all the charges. So here's a black man shooting white police officers in the deep South in Atlanta, and it's completely, you know, let go. And, you know, not only was the evidence all supporting Tupac, but the evidence was that it was a botched assassination attempt, you know. So, and there's a lot more details for why it was a botched assassination attempt. Nonetheless, Jacques Ignant had told these guys this is what's going to be happening with Tupac's whole, you know, itinerary at that time. I argue he was a police, you know, intelligence agent. So then you come into a few weeks later. Jacques Ignant introduces Tupac to this woman in Nell's dance club, this woman named Ayanna Jackson, who, by all witness accounts, and even in her court testimony, she admits that she kissed Tupac's penis on the dance floor. Okay, he introduces her, you know, Tupac to Ayanna Jackson. She just drops her date, starts, you know, dancing with him, unzips his pants, pulls down his pants, and kisses his penis by court testimony. I have the court, you know, trial transcripts in my possession here. And so then he goes back and has sex with her later, you know, that night. And then a day or two later, she calls and says, "I like the way you F-U-C-K, you know, let's do it again." And it's on his, recording machine at his hotel. And he ends up, you know, Jacques Ignant convinces him to invite her back, and she invites her back, and she says, "Oh, they forced, oral sex on me, and they forced, you know, other things on me." And so meanwhile, he woke up like in the next room, not really sure what was going on, feeling like he was drugged. And he's, you know, and he finds out that she's pressing charges against him and the rest of them for forcing her to do all these things. It was like forced sodomy and attempted sodomy and all these other charges. So they heap a ton of charges on him. And it goes through court, and in court, it's looking really bad for the prosecution, you know, and it's looking really good for Tupac. So they actually, prosecution right before the trial's supposed to end, they actually offer a mistrial. But Tupac says, "No, I want it to go all the way." And so, it's out in the jury's deciding. And that night, Tupac's called to recording studio lobby by a close friend of Jacques Ignant's named Jimmy Henchman Rosemont. And he offers him tons of money just to record a few lines on someone's track. And that's at, Quad Studios in, Times Square. So Tupac goes over there. And he's a little too stoned, so he doesn't recognize that something's really off about the situation. He ends up getting shot twice to put him down on the ground, and while he's face down on the ground, he's shot twice in the head. And so I have the court documents of the doctor's affidavit that describe how two bullets went through the back of his skull and out the front of his skull. And it's just miraculous that it missed his brain. These two bullets missed his brain. So he survived that, but that was... loads of evidence show how that was obviously assassination attempt number of 5, most likely, at least 4, if not 5. And so he gets through that, but then the next day he goes to court, you know, or maybe 2 days later, he's in court all bandaged up because he just said, "I just got to show my face. I don't want to look like I'm, you know, I'm not facing the jury." But he's all bandaged up. He was shot in the leg very seriously. His head's all bandaged up. He's groggy, but he's wheeled into the court in a wheelchair. And in court, they find him not guilty of all major charges except touching this woman's butt against her will. Okay. He's found not guilty of sodomy, not guilty of forced sodomy, not guilty of assisting sodomy, not guilty of gun possession. All these charges, except, again, touching her butt against her will of a woman who admitted they both had consensual sex a night or two before. They both admitted that they had oral sex that night. And so they ruled it consensual sex. And so touching her butt after consensual sex gets him up to four and a half years in jail, you know, sentence. It's incredible. Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Jacques Ignant was, admitted guilt to the same thing of touching her butt against her will. And he got a misdemeanor. You know, it's practically a traffic ticket.
Well, and just to jump in there too, you chronicle in the book that Ignat had, he had a PBA rep.
Right.
Bail him out. He had a longtime PBA lawyer represent him.
For people that don't know what that means, it's Police Benevolence Association. A lawyer, guy that represented the, you know, Police Benevolence Association for 2 decades or so. Mm. And that was his lawyer, yeah.
Mm. And so, he was also able to somehow separate himself, like he had a separate right. trial. He wasn't, right. you know, it wasn't Tupac and Ignat, Jackson versus Tupac and Ignat. It was 2 separate right. trials as well, right. which is unheard of.
Which is, yeah, it warrants it. It's highly unusual. It's incredible. And so she and Ayanna Jackson was going completely after Tupac, not going after Ignat at all. Yeah, so it's obvious what was going on there.
And also to talking about the Quad Studio shooting, because that one seems one of the most, if not the most, brazen attempt on his life, obviously excluding what happened in Las Vegas. But you know, you write about that too. I mean, the suspicious stuff somebody had to have buzzed these guys in. You're not getting access into that studio without being on video camera, because they were inside the studio, correct?
Right, they were. And James Henchman Rosemont, there's court documents that show that he was working with the government at various times already. You know, he was working with the government in the mid 90s. And so, he also got Tupac to come there. But the main thing is that a guy named Dexter Isaac said in from prison, and he signed, you know, signed off on saying that he was paid by Rosemont to kill Tupac. So it's all there. Yeah, he was paid now. You know, so the question is, who was Rosemont working for? And I show that in the mid 90s that he was working with the government at one point. You know, was he working for the government to do that specifically? All the evidence, you know, suggests that he was, because of the way the whole situation was handled. You know, it was completely, the whole situation was covered up and called a random mugging, attempted murder.
Even though jewelry was left, he had a diamond encrusted Rolex that they forgot to steal. Also too, it was the same police officers that responded to Ayanna Jackson also responded to the Quad Studio shooting, correct?
Right. Showed up immediately.
Even more bizarre.
Yeah, right. And, when I called the police station and, just said, I wanted to do an article on the, I forgot their name now, that special crimes unit, there's a different name for them, but it was the group, the undercover group of police officers that killed, Amadou Diallo, I believe.
Yeah.
But when I called about them, they said, oh, you know, what kind of article are you doing? I said, I just wanted to do a positive spin on these guys. She says, oh, well then this officer, this supervising officer will be back at this time. And I said, okay, great. And so when I called again, though, she just realized I tricked her. So it basically confirmed that he was part of that unit, the street crimes unit it was called.
Yes.
So that he was part of that street crimes unit, and he was the supervising officer at that scene. So the two police officers under him were likely street crimes also. And so that they were the group that started right when the Bureau of Special Services, the FBI's counterintelligence program unit within the New York Police Department, closed down in 1971. When they closed down, street crimes unit opened up, and that was just another name for the same kind of tactics, you know, the same kind of special officers. So that's what we were dealing with there. But all of this, you know, that I talked to you about got Tupac in this in prison, and they sent him to this maximum security prison, I argue, to use penal coercion tactics on him. And those are like, U.S. intelligence tactics that just, cause massive psychological and emotional, damage to people in prison. And they use that, I argue, and I show all the tactics they use. Amnesty International lays all the tactics out, and I show how they were all used on Tupac. And they use that to convince him that maybe Puffy and Biggie had something to do with his shooting, even though they didn't, you know, evidence shows they didn't. And for him to sign to Death Row Records, even though, you know, all his advisors, you know, said you really shouldn't do this. We don't know exactly what Death Row is, but it's something very suspicious. And so he just felt like he was getting so, messed up in jail with these penal coercion tactics and all. They signed to them just to get out, for any way to get out. And of course, he's let out within days of signing with Death Row Records after he had put up virtually the same amount of money as them for his bail. And, they let him out within days, and Death Row proceeds to use the same tactics against Tupac to keep messing his head up. And Tupac vowed to stop smoking weed and stop drinking so much when he was in prison. And they just lavished him with alcohol and weed all the time to try to keep his head messed up. And they, of course, you know, published the most negative lyrics he published at that time, he had put out at that time. And, but then when he finished his three CDs for Death Row, he said he was done, and he would start his new record label, Euthanasia Records, with one of his associates, Yasmin Fula, who was a close friend of his mother, Fanny Shakur's, and she was the wife of, Sekou Odinga, who had founded the Bronx Black Panthers. And she was a Black Panther in the Bronx. And her son, Yafu Fula, was Tupac's backup singer. And so, but in Death Row Records, you have this high-level police detective named Russell Poole, who just happened to get himself assigned to check out what happened to Biggie Smalls, you know, investigate Biggie Smalls' murder. And Russell Poole finds dozens of his fellow police, Los Angeles police officers at all levels of death row records. So he goes to his superior and says, what are they all doing there? And the superior says, you can call them troubleshooters or covert agents. And, you know, so it just shows what they were all about.
Well, jumping back a little bit, let's talk about death row records, because this was the other aspect of your book that I found so fascinating. Again, it's a sort of I don't know if it's hidden. I mean, a lot of people that are interested in rap will know some of the connections. But we go all the way back to the original founders of Death Row Records, and we get two extremely shady characters. We get Dave Kenner and Harry O. Who are these two guys? How do they fit into the structure of Death Row?
Well, Michael Harry O. Harris, according to Gary Webb, Gary Webb wrote those groundbreaking articles on the CIA Contra crack cocaine, you know, distribution situation back in the mid-1990s, one of the first, articles that went viral on the internet. And in Gary Webb's book about all he investigated about the CIA's cocaine, trafficking, he found that Freeway Ricky Ross was working with these Contras and the CIA traffickers, and two of his associates, two people under him in the network were, one guy's name I forget now, but the other one was Michael Harry O. Harris. Okay. And Dave Kenner was, the lawyer for Michael Harry O. Harris. So when Michael Harry O. Harris, at one point, later finally gets nabbed by the DEA, some honest DEA and goes to jail. He says, well, I want to use all this money. He still had a ton of money from all the, crack distribution. He wanted to start a record company. And so, Dave Kenner starts this record company with him, Death Row Records, and then Sutton hires, Suge Knight as the, director of it. And so, they were part of that CIA, network of crack distribution. And so, so Kenner is the real owner of Death Row Records, and Suge Knight, is more of a figurehead, but he also carries out operations. Now, Suge Knight was committing more violent and more violent crimes all the time and getting, steeper and steeper penalties for those crimes. And then all of a sudden, he doesn't go to court at all for any violent crimes. They're still committing them. And so when you see that progression, the same thing happened with somebody who was inserted into the Black Panthers to help kill Fred Hampton, the head of the Chicago Black Panthers. A guy named, I believe his name's, Eugene O'Neill, or, I forget his name now.
Yeah, Gene something.
Yeah, but whatever it is, so he was inserted into, he had that same criminal history as Knight, where all of a sudden he's still committing violent crimes, but he's not getting charged with anything. They used him and inserted him in the Black Panthers to effect operations against the Panthers. In the same way, Knight was being used, I argue, and I show the evidence, in that regard, by U.S. intelligence. So while he's head of Death Row Records, he's committing all these horrible, violent things against people, and no charges come against him. And when he does some of these things, they end up arresting people like, Dr. Dre and others, but they won't arrest him. They won't arrest Knight. And meanwhile, Russell Poole finds that Death Row is drug trafficking, they're gun running, and they're trying to end the Bloods versus Crips peace truces around Los Angeles. They're even killing people at Death Row concerts, having Bloods kill Crips at Death Row concerts, and no one's getting arrested. So that's what's happening in Death Row Records. That's U.S. intelligence agenda. All those activities are part of what U.S. intelligence have been found to do, and we're working on. And so, then one of the top goals besides those things, though, was to manipulate Tupac to spread the most negative messages in his lyrics. But then when Tupac tried to get away from Death Row Records, it was to kill him, to murder him, to stop his gang peace truce movement, and stop the other things he was trying to do. And so in 1996, when they were, you know, when the, they talked Tupac into going to the Mike Tyson fight, because Tupac actually was, there was a, one of his bodyguards was a guy named Kevin Hackey. Kevin Hackey was a police officer who was also getting paid by the FBI.
And to inform on Tupac, presumably.
To be an agent of some sort. And we don't know exactly how he was being, you know, why he was being paid by the FBI, but obviously it wasn't for anything good.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you know, the history is never good in that regard. And so I argue and show the evidence that Kevin Hackey actually turned on the FBI and, convinced Tupac, you know, temporarily convinced Tupac not to go to Las Vegas the night he was killed. And Tupac was going to actually plan to go to Atlanta instead. But Tupac had gotten a weed possession charge, which actually, you know, actually it wasn't, it was more of a frame up, but it was a weed possession charge. And the judge, kind of looked kindly on Tupac and said he just wanted him to do a benefit concert in, you know, in Las Vegas. And so it was going to be planned. Tupac planned to make that concert. He was going to do that night in Vegas, the benefit concert that would satisfy that. So he decided, well, I'm not going to go to Atlanta. I'll go to Vegas after all. And, just to, you know, satisfy this. And, they, as soon as though, Death Row found out that Hackey had first convinced Tupac to go, to not go to Vegas, they fired Hackey immediately. Yeah. So what was left guarding Tupac, cause Hackey was one of his two main bodyguards, was Frank Alexander and one or two other bodyguards. They all of a sudden were told when they're in Las Vegas that they're not allowed to carry guns to, while they're protecting Tupac. And so, then they're given, cell phones that don't have batteries in them. So this is some part of the setup. And so, Hackey ends up saying on film, in the film Biggie and Tupac, that he has documents to prove that, fellow people being paid by the FBI in the entourage and ATF agents were in the entourage following Tupac when he was murdered. And so obviously they were just making sure the job was done correctly. Because that's what ended up happening. And the whole situation with this Orlando Anderson, Nick Broomfeld, who did the movie Biggie and Tupac, says Orlando Anderson was like the Lee Harvey Oswald of the Tupac assassination. He said that for a small magazine. He said, you know, this was, he was obviously just a, you know, the setup guy or the, you know, what do you call it? The patsy, right.
Orlando Anderson is the character you'll see in the video footage at the MGM Grand where Tupac and others are beating this guy up.
Right.
Orlando Anderson is a, you know, he's allegedly a member of the Crips, which I guess he is. His uncle was a prominent member of the Crips as well.
His uncle was, but it's not so clear that he was. And he did receive a lot of money after he took the beating, and we know that. But it wasn't so clear he was a member of the Crips, but it was obvious what they were trying to do. They were trying to make it look like, oh, well, this is just another gang, you know, beating a gang, you know, murder, you know, with what happened with Tupac. And then when people weren't, and so that actually, so when Tupac got shot and was in the hospital for 7 days before he died, there was actually, you know, Suge Knight spread the word that, oh, the Crips killed Tupac, and there was the Bloods and Crips started warring again. Many people were shot and killed. In 6 or 7 days, and probably due to Dave Kenner and Suge Knight trying to hype the Bloods Crips war again, you know, with Tupac being the spark. And but after Tupac died, activists spread the word that this was not, you know, the Crips that killed Tupac. Someone else killed Tupac, and so the you know, shooting stopped and the peace truce took hold again. But then when they didn't have that effect, they decide, okay, we're gonna kill Biggie and make it look like it was part of the East Coast West Coast, you know, rap war that killed Tupac. And so that lasted a certain period of time, but I think people are finally wising up to the fact that it wasn't part of the East Coast West Coast rap war. This was U.S. intelligence's assassination of Tupac. And so they brought a guy out of early retirement, this guy Greg Kading. But Russell Poole said that he was just a disgraced cop who was caught lying so blatantly in court that they made him retire early. But then they bring him back to write this book, you know, do undercover work and write this book and pretend like, oh, he got the answer. It was really Puffy and Biggie that killed Tupac and then Suge Knight that killed Biggie. But it was really the police officers, you know, the dozens of police officers at all levels, Death Row, that set up Tupac's assassination for U.S. intelligence. And they also, of course, set up a Biggie Smalls assassin, you know, murder. The Biggie was more, it was less political and a little more, collateral damage, to divert, the attention away from their assassination of Tupac Shakur.
Oh, and keep in mind too, people out there that might think this is kind of crazy. Biggie's, wife and mother received a huge payout from the city of LA.
Right.
Because they had withheld all these documents.
Right.
And evidence that pointed to some sort of collusion in his murder. So that's
right.
Out there. It's not, the Biggie one is almost even easier to prove, perhaps.
Oh, it's extremely easy to prove. I mean, they have eyewitnesses to some of the guys that did it and have their connections to the police, officers and death row and all that.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but Russell Poole was a high-level, highly respected police detective, a white police detective. And I say white police detective because that's because they thought he'd be as racist as they were, his superiors. And that's why they told him so much, not realizing that he'd blow the whistle on them.
Mm-hmm.
And so Russell Poole says his own, believes in the film Biggie and Tupac that his own fellow police officers murdered Biggie to throw off the scent from their murder of Tupac Shakur. And he wasn't political, so he didn't know why his fellow police officers murdered Tupac Shakur, but that's what he pretty much lays out in the movie Biggie and Tupac by Nick Broomfield. And he also lays out a lot of this evidence in the book Labyrinth by a veteran, journalist, named Randall Sullivan. And there's supposed to be a movie made about Labyrinth by Johnny Depp that's supposed to be in production now, but we'll see if that actually comes.
Really?
Yeah. Because Sylvester Stallone tried to play the part of Russell Poole and tried to make a movie on the book Labyrinth and just didn't, it was announced and then didn't go all the way.
Huh.
And so now Johnny Depp's trying to do it and he's trying to play Russell Poole. But Russell Poole was still trying to figure out who the actual shooters were of Tupac and, get more information out there. And as he was handing evidence to some fellow police officers, just back about a year ago, he, surprise, surprise, had a heart attack while he was meeting with the police officers, as he's giving new evidence to them. So.
Yeah, no, you talked about in the book, he was set up with certain charges that were sort of trumped up at best. And also again, talking about death row, this isn't like some off-duty cops providing security. We're talking about, Ray Perez? Ray Perez should be familiar to people from the Rampart scandal. I've mentioned Ray Perez on the show, in relation to the O.J. Simpson stuff and talking about Rampart, following all of that. These are big. Ray Perez was one of the inspirations for Denzel Washington's character.
Exactly.
In Training Day.
Yeah.
And Denzel Washington allegedly got his start from Harry O, of all people.
Yeah, that's interesting.
So, these are high-level people. These aren't just sort of mid-level cops providing security. They were running death row.
Right, right. These guys were the real force. And their head was a guy named Reggie Wright that was the director of security.
Yeah.
And Reggie Wright's father was head of the gang unit of Compton Police Department, which is a neighborhood of Los Angeles. And that's one of the places where the Bloods and Crips peace truces first started in Los Angeles. So that's no coincidence because that was a major reason for Death Row Records and for their work. That was what they were trying to do behind the scenes was to end those peace truces. So, yeah.
John, we're coming up towards the commercial break, but there's still a few things I wanted to just sort of get your take on quickly.
Sure.
Do you think that you do lay out, and it makes total sense that Suge Knight was involved in something more than just producing records and things. How you refer to him as very low on the totem pole. Do you think he was ever given, sort of direct orders, or was this sort of like a wink and a nod, in terms of like say the actual killing? Because again, Suge Knight convinces Tupac not to drive in a car with his bodyguards, to instead drive with him alone without anything, and somehow only Tupac is shot. Suge Knight somehow escapes any bullets. He's a big guy too.
Yeah, exactly.
what do you think Suge Knight was ever told something specifically?
Well, the way I've found it usually works with intelligence operations is the higher up you are on the totem pole, the more information you have. The lower you are on the totem pole, the less information you're given. So my guess is that he was given just a little information, but not a lot, you know. And so Dave Kenner had more information. He was a little higher up on the totem pole. But, you know, so the higher up you get, of course, the more you know about all the reasons for these operations. So it's a way I find, you know, other people, other whistleblowers have said it works.
And, of course, Suge Knight has kind of kept his mouth shut about any of this.
Yes,
in spite of his you know, he keeps going to jail, which is also, you know, interesting, too. I mean, they'll just use you until you're useless to them.
Right.
And, you know, completely just sort of throw you to the wolves.
Sure.
You know, I believe Dave Kenner is still his lawyer, but obviously he can't keep Suge Knight out of jail.
Yeah.
Now, also, you know, talking about this sort of like the gang violence and the way this was sort of, you know, fomented and stuff, and kind of parsing this out a little bit more, what are the sort of like big things that kind of come out of this again is like also seems very much like the death of any kind of political message in rap music. And you chronicle too in later years with even people like Jay-Z, Wu-Tang, other groups that, you know, just a modicum of political message and they're gone after. But,
yeah.
You know, what's like the legacy in terms of the death of Tupac?
Well, I think it was partly a warning to other rappers that if they get too political, this is what could happen to them. But the Hip Hop Summit Action Network actually, you know, did try to get rappers more political. They laid out a 12-point program that was not that dissimilar than the Black Panther 10-point program. And, they had people like, Democratic Socialist Professor Manning Marable was part of their board, you know. Russell Simmons helped start it. He got P. Diddy involved. He got, you know, other people involved like Kwesi Mfume, who was a member of the, you know, Black Congressional Caucus, who's a, you know, one of the more leftist of the congressional, you know, leaders. And if you can call congressional leaders leftist, but he was radical the most. So it actually did have some good activists, working in that group, advising the group, being on the board of that group. And so they started getting some rappers more political. And the problem is the people that got involved in the group and got more political also got targeted. And so, Jay-Z tried to get a little bit more political and was targeted. Talked to his lawyer. They, tried to make up on film that he stabbed somebody, and, you know, and they didn't even show the whole film. When the lawyer got the whole film, it showed that he was in the opposite end of the room where this person was stabbed. And then they did, you know, Selective Service, I said, visited Eminem at his home to warn him about, his political, you know, movement. Basically Eminem had a video called Mosh. I don't know if you remember it, but it showed like tons of people storming the White House to stop the Iraq War. And so he just, you know, there was a number of people that were apolitical and were being manipulated, but then when they started getting political, this is what happened. And with P. Diddy, after he got involved with the, you know, Hip Hop Summit Action Network, they said when I was in New York, they said on the news that there was more money spent on P. Diddy's gun possession charge than had ever been spent on a gun possession charge in New York City. And he still got found not guilty because the evidence was just blatant that this was a guy that just basically tried to shoot and kill P. Diddy in this club. Mm. And that was the main witness for the prosecution against P. Diddy. Mm-hmm. And so it's just so much about that. And P. Diddy was barely, you know, it just started getting political. He wasn't political before that. And so it's just a major warning to these guys. If you get political, you know, we're going to target you.
Mm-hmm. And absolutely.
Sadly enough, they killed Jam Master Jay, though. And that was caught on film, and they never showed the film.
Yeah, I did, just like the film, of course, of Tupac. But John, we are at the break right now. Tell everybody where they can go to pick up a copy of the FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders.
Sure. Yeah, it's available in some independent bookstores, but you can also get it at Amazon.com, where you can get a signed copy if you want from my website. which is in, you look it up at FBIWarOnTupac.com. It's www.FBIWarOnTupac.com. And I also have a film based on the book available for sale on the website too. Okay?
Excellent. And we will link up to all of that in the show notes for this. I've been speaking with John Podash. I will try and see if John wants to join us a little bit more in the second hour, but I will be talking to you soon.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Pierce.
Welcome to the world's meeting place. American.
It's practically narcotic.
Freedom.
Oh, yes. I like very much.
Radio.
You're an American institution.
American Freedom Radio.
And I hope people support American Freedom Radio. And I hope people vote with their dollars and really understand the value of having American Freedom Radio. Because that's my family. If you love me at all, Jack Blood, support American Freedom Radio. Like, my family has literally disowned me in American Freedom Radio. Danny and Don and those guys, those are my actual family. So please, please support these guys because they have all the technology. They have all these great things that they're going to do, but obviously they can't do it all by themselves. So not only would I like to see you support them, I'd like to see you retweet them and repost them and really get involved and get on the bandwagon, so to speak, on doing that do-it-yourself promotion, because they're a do-it-yourself radio network, and we just need that so much.
Did you know there are 3 million edible food plants on Earth, and none have the nutritional value of the hemp plant? HempUSA.org offers you hemp protein powder. It does not contain chemicals or THC, is non-GMO, and is 100% gluten-free. Hemp protein powder burns fat, builds muscle, contains 53% protein, and feeds the body the nutrients it needs. Call 888-910-4367 and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org. HempUSA.org introduces 3 brand new detox formulations of micro plant powder. Brain Fuel for depression, bipolar disorders, and stress. Total Care, anti-cancer agent that cleans the liver and organs and increases memory. Rejuvenate, invigorates and heals the body, mind, and spirit. These products are your alternative to pharmaceuticals. Call 888-910-4367 and like us on Facebook. We ship worldwide. Only at HempUSA.org.
What about show business? Show business, completely dishonest, corrupt, and full of shit, but in a nice way. Plenty of expensive drugs and perverted sex. If you're going to be full of shit, might as well enjoy your work. Then you have the media. Not just the news media, let's include them all. The media are almost literally exploding with bullshit because they're located right at the crossroads of all the other bullshit. The media are made up of equal parts advertising, politics, business, public relations, and show business. These people are sitting right at bullshit junction. There's enough bullshit in the media for Texas to open a branch office. And you still have enough left over to start 2 law firms and a Christian bookstore.
What has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Provide us for free education?
Well, that's obviously effective, but apart from reversing the dumbing down of America...
All the information they provide is free?
What about the free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, man?
Exploiting commonplace corruption?
They help vulnerable people who don't have a voice?
Bringing light to important information nobody else does. Or they never censor, hung up, or cut off their guests?
Well, that's not fun, is it?
Oh, they created a fantastic alternative media source during an era of bad, manipulative, and infiltrated mainstream and alternative media shows and scum.
Okay, well, apart from the free education, free information, free podium for broadcast activists to speak from, exposing commonplace corruption, helping vulnerable people without a voice, bringing light to important information nobody else does, and creating a fantastic commercial-free alternative media source in a sea of bad, manipulative, mainstream, and alternative media shills and scum, what has American Freedom Radio ever done for us?
Donate to American Freedom Radio today.
No rules.
laws, no rules, no taboo topics, no taboo topics, no fear of doom, no fear of doom. We are American Freedom Radio. American Freedom Radio.
Porkins Policy Radio, offering a unique perspective on everything. Geopolitics, culture creation, the reality of the world we live in. Coming to you live from New York City, your host, Pierce Redmond.
Okay, everybody, welcome back to Porkins Policy Radio. I am your host, Pierce Redmond. You are listening to this here on American Freedom Radio, AmericanFreedomRadio.com. If you are just joining us right now for the second hour, in the first hour, we were speaking with John Podash all about his excellent, excellent book, The FBI War on Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders. Unfortunately, I could not convince John to stick around for the second hour. He had a bunch of stuff to do, and that's fine. I think we covered quite a bit of ground in just an hour. If you are hearing some background noise, what may sound like a hammer banging, that is my landlord doing a little bit of construction in my living room and on my roof. So apologies if that is coming through, but not much I can do about that. But as I said, I think we covered some really great stuff with John on that, and he's, you know, kind of like condensed this down. You know, he if you search for other radio shows and podcasts with John Podash, you'll see, you know, he's talked for hours on end about this. But so he definitely has condensed everything down into a great, you know, hour long conversation about the book. But I hope that really just encourages people to go out and get a copy. I really, really do recommend it. Of course, the links to pick up the book will all be in the show notes below. So definitely go and pick it up. There's lots of other little tiny strands and stuff that we didn't get to cover that I think I will try and cover at another time. I might try to put together I'd love to do maybe a whole episode just on Death Row Records. And there's some other really great books that John references throughout his FBI Tupac book. So maybe we'll do a whole series or an episode or two on Death Row Records and because there's lots of these little great details and stories that are in the footnotes and other places in John's book that are amazing. But before I forget, this is something people might have seen this on Twitter, but I didn't mention in the first hour just because I, you know, wanted to get as much in with John. But issue of the American Journal of Economics and Sociology that features yours truly, as well as Aaron Franz, Tom Secker, our good friend Matthew Alford, Tarzi from the Rancid Honey Trap blog, and many, many other excellent writers, is finally out. So that is volume 76, issue 2 of the American Journal of Economics and Sociology. The entire issue revolves around the topic of CIA as well as Pentagon influence in Hollywood, and also in some other interesting. There's an article, for instance, by Peter Mantello, which is all about video games and the arms culture, arms industry. We've got I'll go through them real quickly. So we've got my article, which is the historical roots of CIA Hollywood propaganda. That is the first article in the issue. So sort of setting up the whole stage for what will be discussed later. Then we've got Gray Matters on Screen: Intelligence Agencies, Secret Societies, and Hollywood Movies. This is written by good friend Aaron Franz. Then we've got The Many Layers of Meaning of 007 by Jay Dyer, followed by the article that I cannot wait to read, which is Edward Snowden, Frenemy of the State, which is by Tarzi. And for people that don't know Tarzi's stuff, really encourage you to check out the Rancid Honey Trap blog, and you can find that at otarzi.wordpress.com. Excellent, excellent stuff. It was great to get Tarzi in on this project. Then we've got an article by Tom Secker and our good friend Matthew Alford, the writer behind The Writer with No Hands, excellent book on Gary DeVore, entitled Why Are the Pentagon and CIA in Hollywood? Then we've got an article, Transforming Transformers into Militainment, Interrogating the DOD Hollywood Complex by Tanner Mirlas. Then we've got another article by Tom entitled The Soviet-Afghan War in Fiction. Very excited to read that in its entirety. Then we've got an article by Robin Anderson. Anderson. called Learning to Love Biomimetic Killing, How Jurassic World Embraces Life Forms as Weapons. Cannot wait to read that. That was one that I remember when we were first sort of coming up with different ideas and writers and stuff. That was one that I was like super excited to see. And then the final article is by Peter Mantello, entitled Military Shooter Video Games and the Ontopolitics of Derivative Wars and Arms Culture. Excellent stuff. There's also an editor's introduction by Clifford Cobb, who's the editor over at the American Journal of Economics and Sociology, called Reeled into Complacency, How the CIA and the Pentagon Uses Hollywood to Shape Our Ideas About Friends and Enemies. So very exciting. I know I have spoken about this before on the radio show and on some of the podcasts and stuff. If you can't wait to read my stuff, to read my article or other people's, you can go on to the Wiley Online Library. I will link up in the show notes for this. Wiley is the publisher publishes the American Journal of Economics and Sociology. I believe just their online, or no, maybe it's all of their stuff. And you can go to that website, and you can, you know, if you click on my article, you can get full access. You just click at the bottom, get access. Wow, I can't say that. To see text or full article, and you can, I think it's for like $6. You can rent it, so you can just sort of read it. I think you have it for 48 hours. You can get the PDF version, which is $38, which I know is a little pricey, but the print issue is only $10, and that's got all the articles, gorgeous, you know, printed journal. And I will be picking up a couple copies for some of the other writers involved in the project, but also for some friends and stuff. And I will have a bunch of them to send out to any listeners out there who are interested in getting a copy of that. I will try and get some more as well. So if there is interest in getting a physical paper copy signed by me, if you want to, if you don't, that's totally fine. But if you do want it, signed copy, I'm more than happy to do that, and I will send it out to you. So let me know. I want to see what the interest is, you know, how many people actually want one. I know, Josh, I'm sure you are listening, I will be sending you a copy. You were part of my list of people to send it to, so I will be sending one to you, Josh. So any of the subscribers out there, if you're interested, let me know. I'm thinking of maybe doing like a raffle or something for signed copies, but if there is a big interest in this, we can set something up. So you know, maybe you know, if you sign up in the month of March or just anyone that signs up to Patreon. We'll have to figure it out exactly. I'd love to throw in a signed copy of the journal. So anyone out there listening, let me know if you do want one. We'll figure out a way for me to send them over to you. But I will have a bunch of them that I'd love to give away. So let me know about that. But enough of me kind of babbling on about the journal. And I think we'll have more to come on that. I'd love to get some of the other writers involved on the show maybe to talk about this. But let's get back to what we were talking about in the first hour with John Podesh. And as I said, there's lots of various aspects and factors of John's book that are really fascinating. And it's something that it was something that really struck me reading his book is the role of corporations and the role of the corporatist structure that dictates so much control over our lives. And this is there is quite a bit of this throughout John's book, because of course while you've got groups like the FBI, you've got all these various police intelligence units, you've got COINTELPRO, you've got CIA people, there's all these people sort of around Tupac and doing things to him, threatening him, attacks on his life, trying to control him. There is also the corporate side to this. There there are the Time Warners. Of course, Time Warner was the company that owned all of Tupac's records. Tupac worked for Time Warner when he was at first at Interscope and then later at Death Row Records. And the Time Warner in particular played a very important and prominent role in the rap world, in that they owned most of the record companies that produced rap music. And this sort of got me to thinking about just the sort of corporatist structure that we see ourselves in today, because for a variety of reasons that I think we'll explore a little bit more in this second hour, that seems to be kind of like ignored, or people are not paying attention to the corporate takeover, to the corporate side, to the infamous deep state, which apparently nobody wants to talk about that, that aspect of it. But speaking specifically about Tupac, because again, it's such a fascinating subject. There's a chapter 20 of John's book is entitled U.S. Intelligence and the Mafia, How It Shaped R&B, Rock, CIA, and Time Warner's Rap Grip. And he begins by talking about John McCaw, John Elroy McCaw, who was a former OSS man, and then would also go on to be a member of the National Security Council. This was in the 50s, I believe. And he was also very famous because he owned WIMS, which was one of and I think it might still even be to this day, New York's sort of top music station. And they owned lots of the radio stations. They controlled, from New York, they were able to control pop music and the directions that music were going in. And you got this former OSS man, head of the National, or a member, excuse me, of the National Security Council, running a radio station, or multiple radio stations. And he was also a good friend with Morris Levy, who we mentioned back in the Al Sharpton episode. Morris Levy, people might remember from that episode, he is the inspiration for Hesh in The Sopranos. Morris Levy set up Roulette Records, which was a very famous jazz and R&B record company. Was also a front for heroin trafficking. Morris Levy was deeply involved in organized crime, through the various mafia figures. For more about Morris Levy, you can check out the episode on Al Sharpton. But Morris Levy was also friends with John McCaw, and the two of them were able to convince Alan Freed to come and join the WINS network. And Alan Freed, they employed him in 1945, but Alan Freed is very famous for having coined the term rock and roll and popularizing it, just as a radio DJ. And he had this sort of monumental career in a very short span of time, from like 1954 to the very, 1961, while he was at, working for WINS and working with Morris Levy. And WINS is also very famous for, they created the idea of the top 40 music format. That idea, that concept was invented by WINS and popularized by people such as Alan Freed. Now, Alan Freed popularized rock and roll music. He popularized broadly speaking, black music. Like I said, R&B, a lot of the sort of early in the mid 50s into the early 60s, a lot of very famous black musicians, you know, were popularized by people such as Alan Freed, who, again, popularized their music to a white audience. Very important in understanding this sort of paradigm. And again, you can see how that affects Tupac later. And Freed's monumental career would sort of be destroyed in the Payola scandal. But, you know, John sort of talks about that in the beginning, again, kind of linking in these, because there's other mafia characters and things like that, and you know, why would you have an OSS guy sort of helping to popularize rock music? Well, he also talks again about Time Warner itself, or Time Inc., which is run for many, many years by C.D. Jackson, an expert on CIA psychological warfare, very nasty individual, and Time Warner would, by the end of the 1990s, would own 20 formerly independent rap labels, and they would incorporate all of them under the Time Warner brand. And Time Warner would routinely censor Tupac's albums. They would, you know, they would insist that things be removed. Time Warner, famous for I think it was an Ice-T's Cop Killer song. They threw a big hissy fit about that, and they recalled a lot of the records and things. Time Warner also teamed up with Quincy Jones to found Vibe Magazine. And through founding Vibe Magazine, they were able to control the journalistic output in the rap community, to the extent that even though Quincy Jones ostensibly is the founder of Vibe Magazine, he had almost no control over editorial input or anything. And Jones famously had to at one point write a letter to the magazine simply to voice his own opinions. And this is, this is not unheard of. Like The Source, which is another big rap magazine, white owned for many, many years. And here we go. We got the endless fire trucks in my neighborhood, just with the hammer banging in the background. So sorry again for the noise. But, you know, this sort of got me to thinking more about the influence that the big massive corporations have. Because Time Warner was able, as I said, they control Vibe, so they can control what people are saying about Tupac. They can control Tupac by censoring his songs, by, you know, influencing other people around him. And they can create a narrative, and they can create culture. They can heighten the East-West rap beef. They can heighten other things. And that's very powerful. And this kind of control seems to be coming worse and worse and more pronounced. And a lot of these ideas for this, you know, whatever, this part of the episode also kind of comes from Tom and I were talking a couple days ago or maybe a week ago about this, this whole concept. And Tom made this sort of great observation, and it's been kind of stuck in my head for the past couple of days. So that's why I wanted to talk about it. But he was saying that corporations are now acting more and more like countries, and countries are acting more and more like nationalist corporations. Now, I think with corporations, we're beginning to see this. It's like a more straightforward sort of a notion, and I think we've been able to kind of recognize that many of these large multinational corporations are really powerful entities have been acting like countries. You know, they can go into a country, they can do whatever the hell they want to. They can take over and things. And I will talk about that in a little bit. But the concept that countries are now acting like nationalist corporations, I think, is this sick symptom of the incestuous relationship between countries and corporations, or between politicians and corporations. So, you know, you see countries sort of hosting these sporting events, selling themselves. So, like, like Azerbaijan has been doing this quite a bit. They, you know, they got like a Formula One race there. They did Eurovision. I think the European Games was held in Baku, and they're sort of selling themselves as this company, as this product. You know, you should come to Azerbaijan and do this sort of thing. And it's sort of odd behavior for a country. And you're seeing this also, for me, I see this quite a bit with some of the sports teams, particularly in, like, say, the world of cycling, which is one of the topics of my recent subscriber podcast. But there's lots of countries now sponsoring cycling teams. So there's always been Astana, which is basically Kazakhstan, attempting to get good PR. But now you've got Bahrain Merida. So the country of Bahrain is sponsoring a cycling team. They've got a former guy from Astana, Vincenzo Nibali, very famous cyclist, on the team. But and even creepier, the team is run by one of the, you know, sons of the sheikh who controls Bahrain. But this guy personally, it's like a known torturer that, you know, he personally during the uprisings during the Arab Spring would go and torture prisoners for fun. This guy is now selling his country again as this team. You know, it's like they're taking the idea of this corporate sponsorship to this like new level where you're selling the country as a product. The United Arab Emirates also sponsoring a cycling team. And we see this with other things too. You know, Arab Emirates has sponsored soccer teams and those sorts of things. And Tom brought up another interesting example of this country selling themselves, acting like corporations. When you look at something like the recent James Bond film, Spectre, and Mexico selling itself to, they desperately wanted to be featured in the Bond film, even though, I mean, really, it's like for what? It's like 10 minutes max of, like a chase scene in Mexico City. Spend millions of dollars and stuff. And, where is Mexico getting this? Why are they doing it? You know, instead of building schools and things like that, they want to sell themselves to some Hollywood corporation. And that's a sort of very kind of scary idea when you have a country acting very much like a nationalist corporation, where they're no longer about building schools or helping underprivileged people or hospitals and things like that. No, what they're really about is, well, we need to put on a new sporting event. We need to get into this new Hollywood film. We need to sell this phony image. We need to sell our country. We need to sell our people, essentially, as products. And this whole idea kind of got me to thinking, of course, can't escape it, about Trump. Because I think he has brought this to a new level with his cabinet and with his ideology. So in spite of the perceived notion out there that the deep state is some sort of amorphous, omnipotent force which is hell-bent on attacking Trump, and which solely kind of consists of the Democrats, the, you know, globalist leftists, and the CIA, you know, and then to a lesser extent, I suppose the NSA, and even though, you know, Trump is so buddy-buddy with the FBI is probably also after him. But basically, when most of the idiots who are now using the term deep state use it, they really mean the CIA and Obama. That's the extent of the deep state to them. Now, really, and I myself am guilty, and I have said this before in recent shows, that I'm guilty of kind of overusing the term, because the CIA is not the deep state. The deep state is not the CIA, the FBI, the NSA, military intelligence, MI6, BND, Mossad. It's not all of these intelligence agencies combined, even. The deep state refers much more to a complex relationship between groups such as the CIA, but the way that they interact and work with corporations, foundations, the media, things like ExxonMobil and Goldman Sachs. That's the deep state. When you're talking about corporate boardrooms, you're talking about, you know, guys like, I don't know, maybe the CEO of ExxonMobil or, one of the heads of Goldman Sachs. And then they get into government. Oh, just like Rex Tillerson at State, ExxonMobil, and Steve Mnuchin at the Treasury Department of Goldman Sachs. That is the deep state, the corporate banking side of all of this, which is sadly kind of being ignored. That's no longer on people's radar. I think in part we get this that notion persists because, you know, Obama was this globalist socialist who, you know, wanted to, I guess, crush all of the wonderful corporations that never do anything bad and turn the world into some sort of communist, UN proxy state. So for many people, I suppose, yeah, these corporations don't exist or they don't hold the kind of power or the perception of power in people's minds anymore, but they do. And Donald Trump is sort of, I think, kind of paving the way for the more of the sort of normalization of all of this. It would be if Obama had appointed the head of Goldman Sachs, and, you know, don't let's not kid ourselves. He was appointing all sorts of people from Goldman Sachs and Chase and things like that. But in the position of Treasury, we would never hear the end of it. Yet Donald Trump does it, and he's a genius, you know. He's smart because you know what he's doing. He's using those guys who were part of the deep state, but they were really good. You know, Rex Tillerson and Mnuchin. They were a part of that whole world. But they know where all the bodies are buried. They're gonna help. We'll get the pedos and it'll all be okay. It's all gonna be okay because they know and they're gonna help Trump and they'll defeat the CIA and that's the real deep state and Obama and Hillary and all those. Podesta and that. But that's not true. What's really happening is the normalization of the corporate takeover. We should be horrified that the CEO of ExxonMobil is running the State Department. What even fucking qualifies him at that point, you know? Goldman Sachs head running Treasury? Why don't we just all bring our money over to Goldman Sachs and just give it to them at that point? And, you know, the way that Trump talks about America, it's always as if it's this product in need of a rebranding or some sort of management shakeup. When he talks about America, it's always, you know, it's going to be good. It's the new and improved. Cleans better. It does better. It makes more money. It does this. And it's all about this sort of, you know, shaking up the system. We got to drain this hole. We got to get new management in here. That's what's the problem. It's really all these old cronies and, we need a corporate shakeup and a new CEO. And then, you know, he uses these words like deal. You know, everything is a deal to him. Business. This is about, again, normalizing this corporate bullshit speak. A deal. You know, everything is tremendous, amazing, huge. These are all slogans that you use in business, particularly if you're shitty at business, you know, and you only have, your thesaurus is only, you know, contains about 10 words in it. But he's using all of these sorts of terms and things. Even the whole, who will save America? U.S. Steel. U.S. Steel is going to save America. Now, leaving aside that U.S. Steel as a company no longer exists, what Trump is really doing, you know, he's talking about U.S. Steel. He's conjuring up this idea that it's more like this natural resource that's grown in America. U.S. Steel, you know, just comes right out of the ground. It's this wonderful American product. Not that it's really massive multinational corporations that own these steel companies, you know, Chinese investors and Indian investors, you know, it doesn't matter. It could be all sorts of different people. But the way that he speaks about it again as if it's this natural resource, this wonderful thing that's this idea, this great notion, U.S., United States Steel. It's going to help save America. It's going to build that Keystone Pipeline. Now, of course, this is sadly not the case, apparently. And that just sort of, you know, in one ear, out the other, you know, let alone that you've got all these Trump fanatics and so-called awake people out there championing the Keystone Pipeline all of a sudden as if this is a great thing. You know, they didn't really, you know, give too much of a or didn't say too much about it prior. You know, they might get lip service to, you know, people being attacked and stuff like that. But now that Trump's going, it's okay. I don't care. It doesn't matter. And, of course, U.S. steel manufacturers aren't even going to be used to build this. But even that, you know, even this notion of the Keystone Pipeline, that is somehow, again, this corporate pipeline. I can't remember the exact name, but, you know, the Canadian energy company that's going to build this. That they are going to also save us. Again, that the corporations are going to make America great again. They're going to make America safe again too. Because of course the geopolitically, the pipeline is always sold as this way to stop our dependence on the Saudis and Middle Eastern oil monarchies and you know, Middle East oil in general, which will stop the foreign wars. This will bring peace and stability. Suddenly the Israelis and the Palestinians will be holding hands. Peace in the Middle East will happen. You know, the dictators will fall, all because some Canadian oil company is going to build a big old massive pipeline that's probably going to poison all of, you know, the water and displace all sorts of people. That's going to save us. That's going to, you know, again, oil companies acting as countries. The oil companies in this case, they're acting as the mediators of our problems. The oil companies are going to protect us from the evils of Middle Eastern oil excess. So again, it's countries acting, corporations acting like countries and countries acting like nationalist corporations. Use us. Yes, we're the best company to choose. America, you know, American Steel, or you know, use our land to build on. Again, we're selling ourselves to these corporations. And in my opinion, Donald Trump is making this much more, you know, acceptable. And then let's look at it from the perspective of again, when you look at the Keystone Pipeline. And the only kind of point is, I know that I don't think I've previously spoken about the Keystone Pipeline on a radio show, but you know, I've been following it, and I guess maybe I'm feeling a little guilty that I haven't said enough on the radio show about it. You know, I just wanted to bring it up just because it was just wonderful. Wonderful to see people kind of getting excited about it or getting motivated by it. Particularly those, you know, on the left, that kind of gave Obama a lot of a pass, and that was one of the, you know, things that they were, you know, that's a dark mark against him. Appeared as a topic when Trump came in, and it will definitely happen. They will definitely build that pipeline. I guess they were probably going to build it under Obama. They might have, you know, they might have been able to make at least enough of a public display of you know, protest against it that it would be harder to do it, perhaps. Whereas with Trump, I mean, it just seems like it's in the bag. There's really no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But it's also a great example, again, of these corporations acting like countries and the deep state rearing its ugly head. So again, you know, with oil companies, energy companies, definitely part of the deep state, wanting to use America to build this pipeline because they're going to save us. They're going to save us from those the Saudis. So you know, no one will be buying the Saudis oil. So I guess they'll stop funding terrorism and those sorts of things. But look from the perspective of some of the indigenous tribes protesting this. Let's look at the perspective from the Rosebud Sioux tribe, who has called the Keystone XL pipeline a, quote, act of war. Because what's going on here is this corporation is coming and invading and occupying what is a sovereign nation, as dictated by the federal government. The various tribes, not just the Sioux, but also Lakota, all these other things, are supposed to be sovereign nations. And now you've got this corporation invading and occupying a sovereign nation. They're using a mercenary firm, Tiger Swan, Deep State, hello, alert, make sure that construction isn't hindered, to deal with protesters, to infiltrate protester groups, to create intelligence files, intelligence networks, to derail all these things. The CEO of Tiger Swan is none other than James Reese, who's an Army Delta Force, former member of the Army Delta Force, and was the, get this, lead advisor for special operations to the director of the CIA for planning operations and integration for the invasion of Afghanistan and Operation Enduring Freedom in Iraq. And on top of it, he was also an advisor to Blackwater, that other wonderful mercenary firm, that's another extension or a part of the deep state that just is, it's like it doesn't exist. Blackwater is fine. Eric Prince is great because Eric Prince, you know, he hates Anthony Weiner and he knows all the dirty secrets and he's gonna help us. We're gonna get those pedophiles because that's really all the deep state is to these people. No, this is what we're talking about. You've got this mercenary firm, Tiger Swan, going in and helping to occupy the sovereign nation of the Sioux people, the Sioux Nation, in order to build this pipeline for some corporate entity. At that point, there is almost nothing separating these corporations from countries. They are essentially countries. They are acting as their own sovereign countries, going around doing whatever the fuck they want to. And I see this more and more. This sort of concept has become so kind of normalized. Seeing all these CEOs and whatnot, within the White House or within the cabinet, you want to talk about some of these whack jobs out there who want to go on and on about the deep state and deep politics and these things. Peter Thiel is the deep state, okay? This guy is, he's helping to found Facebook, essentially, okay? Certainly, CIA money involved in that. Peter Thiel, gives the initial $500,000 to get them off their feet just after the CIA invests in his company, Palantir. Palantir, of course, Alexander Karp, CEO of Palantir, was at all those early meetings with Donald Trump when he brought in all these, men, these titans of industry and Silicon Valley CEOs and all the great CEOs are tremendous, tremendous people. They're going to, do great, great deals in these things. What's Alex Karp doing there? Comparatively speaking, his company is not that large or important. They're definitely Palantir is overvalued, and only because their sole source of income comes from the CIA, and then to a lesser extent the DOD and then the FBI and there's lots of other government entities that use Palantir, but the major ones are government contracts or military and intelligence contracts. That's the deep state. Why is this guy fucking hanging around with Donald Trump? Why is Peter Thiel have Donald Trump's ear? So much of the deep state as we know it now comes from Silicon Valley. Okay, they're all out in Palo Alto. They are the means with which the deep state and deep politics can function. You need these people in Silicon Valley. Why do you think Amazon wants to they want to have a product that or a service where you buy everything Soon they'll be sending to you on drones. They control the media in that they, you know, they've Washington Post, and I'm sure they'll buy up other media things. And why do you think that Amazon is also helping the CIA build its cloud-based service? Why do you think they're also creating the entertainment that you consume through Amazon, their Amazon Prime or whatever service? So now they're creating the information for you as well. And these companies are all, you know, Trump is welcoming them all in with open arms. He has no qualms about this because guess what, everyone? He is the deep state. He's just a bit of an idiot when it comes to talking. He thinks that it is this force that is out to get him, but only because he's got a bunch of other idiots around him telling him that. But that aside, his idiocy and stupidity aside, the notion of corporations acting like countries is becoming scarier. You know, when you've got a corporation building this pipeline that uses a paramilitary mercenary army made up of former special forces and CIA operatives, and they are basically above the law because they essentially create the laws. Well, you know, they've won. The corporate takeover is complete. And then what does that leave more and more are countries selling themselves as a product, begging for their, you know, their business, for their, the patronage and things. That's a really scary position to be in. Now, this isn't to say like the reverse of all this, you know, the corporation should be small, but the government is mighty. That's not what I'm saying, but it's a dangerous realm to be moving into, particularly when so many of these, these corporations, they don't really have your best interests at heart ever. They don't really care about you. They only care that you buy their product or that you accept their product, that you can tolerate their product, whatever that may be. And that we are acquiescing so much power to them is really scary. And again, I think that's a big part of why perhaps so many people in the business world, in the CEOs of Fortune 500 companies, have thrown their support behind Donald Trump, because he makes this possible. He makes it easier for the average person to accept this. And maybe a lot of that is because the average person is looking at all the wrong things. They're looking at the latest idiotic tweet by Donald Trump. They are, they're obsessed with this is what's funny. You've got the sort of establishment and many people on the left, but the establishment as a whole denying the existence of the deep state. Okay. They're always, I was just sort of flipping around the channels the other day and it was like around like 7 o'clock. So it's like, all the news, CNN, MSNBC, Fox are all basically talking about the same thing. You go to Anderson Cooper, he's talking about this wiretap story. Bill O'Reilly, wiretap story. MSNBC, it's like Chris Hayes, wiretap story. And I was flipping around and I was on the Chris Hayes' show for about the 30 seconds. I can handle that. And he's got some Washington Post journalist there, and he said, the Washington Post journalist, the so-called deep state, and he's sort of poo-pooing it, as if this doesn't exist. Of course, those are the same people that will say, oh, well, in other countries, yeah, of course, Turkey's got the deep state, and the Ergenekon network and all of that, that's real, but that's because we know about the Turks, too. They're, the brown people are always sort of, they're up to those nasty things. But here in the West, we sort of progress beyond that and democracy and freedom and all that kind of crap. But, and then on the other side of the question, the equation, you've got the so-called alternative, mostly the right-wing idiots at this point who've taken over the movement. They're believing that the deep state is really this sort of leftist, democratic force along with the CIA that hates the Russians, and the neocons are kind of a part of it, but it's really this sort of amorphous, intelligence democratic network that hates Trump, you know, Trump is he's the hero, and he's you know, and of course Donald Trump's constant claims, like things like the wiretapping business with Obama, that of course reinforces that notion that yes, the evil deep state is out to get them. They're out to you know, take over and take him down. He's gonna get assassinated like Kennedy and all that kind of crap. So you've got, you know, one group denying its existence and another group basically lying about its or presenting a bogus version of its existence. When in reality, you know, if you go to, say, Peter Dale Scott, his definition of the deep state and how it works, he's very much talking about oil companies, big banks, arms manufacturers, mercenary firms, you know, foundations, corporate, you know, boardrooms, those sorts of entities that work in tandem with the White House, with the CIA, with, you know, the Treasury Department, the State Department, come on. Though the relationship between those two, when they're sort of, objectives all line up, that's when the deep state is really kind of, you know, getting the gears moving. When, you know, ExxonMobil, Goldman Sachs, Blackwater, and the CIA, when their goals are all, you know, aligned, or then and they're all working in tandem in order to produce the desired result, that's the deep state in action. Okay, it's not Obama allegedly wiretapping Donald Trump, and that story is just really does not have legs. But that aside, so where am I going with all of this? And, you know, that's becoming my new phrase for these hours where it's just me. Where am I going with all of this? Well, where I'm going with all of this is to say that the corporate takeover of our country and indeed of the world is becoming a much more tangible reality in a lot of ways. If you are willing to look, if you are willing to open your eyes and look at this truthfully, I think you will see that these entities are indeed becoming more powerful, more omnipotent in the influence that they exert, that the power, the things they can get away with. This is all becoming, it's much more in your face and tangible. And at the same time, there are so many wonderful distractions out there that it's very easy for people to get so, again, it's we're still back to these like identity politics. This guy, that guy, this one, this, that, and the other thing. You know, we got to concern ourselves with these sort of petty issues. What did Donald Trump say? Oh, my God, he said this. What did that liberal say? Oh, he said that. Oh, the pedos are coming. The pedos are coming. We got to string them up. You get so kind of mixed up and lost in the details that you're not seeing that. Does anyone fucking know what Rex Tillerson has been doing? No, because he doesn't give press conferences. He never speaks. And apparently the media just doesn't follow this fucking guy around at all. I mean, he's going to these countries and stuff. Is there a press pool with him? No, God forbid. The same thing with Mnuchin. Or Mnuchin, excuse me. Mnuchin, I just realized that's how you say his name. Mnuchin. Mnuchin. Does anyone have a concept of what this fucking clown is doing at the Treasury Department? No. God forbid. God forbid we even begin to focus on those things. Because, no, instead we have to be focused on these petty issues. We have to be, you know, we're all arguing over what's fake news. You know, is it the mainstream? Is it the alternative? Is it this sort of source or that source? Left, right, conservative, liberal, leftist, this, that. When all that's really done is reinforce the idea that we need to be so fucking gripped by the news cycle, that when you wake up in the morning, you've got to instantly check Twitter. You got to see what are the hashtags, what's the latest thing, you know, who's just been outed as a some sort of sex pervert, who just did something illegal, what was the stupid thing that this person said and the stupid thing that this person said in response to that. And we're going to follow that for 24 hours. What did Kellyanne Conway do? What silly picture got taken? We're going to follow the news cycle, even though that in and of itself is like fake. I mean, a lot of these stories are fake news in that it's not news. There's nothing that you're really gaining from this. There's nothing, there's no revelation in any of this. It's basically like entertainment packaged as news. Okay. That's not news. That's infotainment. that's what's so funny. All these people that are so obsessed with that. Chasing that story, pointing out which is the real fake news. And, oh, it's CNN. No, it's really, Zero Hedge or InfoWars or it's the New York Times. That's irrelevant. All they're really doing is you're feeding the beast that is the news cycle, particularly the 24-hour news cycle. Well, all these stories are garbage anyway. And, you know, in 2 weeks' time, no one is even going to pay attention to it. But, we should probably be paying attention to what the former head of ExxonMobil is doing in the State Department, and even more importantly, what the current CEO of ExxonMobil is doing through that corporation. Okay, because I guarantee you, you know, Rex Tillerson is ultimately doing what will benefit that company because he'll return to that company. The same way that when Bush and Obama and when Trump has appointed all of these bankers from Goldman Sachs and Chase and other things, they all ultimately did what would benefit them when they returned to those jobs. Because we live in a world where government and country, that's nothing. Okay? Those are temporary. Okay? But these corporations, they are forever. They will live on forever because they have become so powerful. They have become countries. The U.S. is simply just a product, a small business that will eventually implode as an entity. You know, will no longer exist, except for maybe selling sports events and sports teams and things like that. But really, the ExxonMobils and Goldman Sachs's and the Blackwaters and Tiger Swan and Palantir, Amazon, Facebook, those will live on forever, indefinitely, because they've risen up. They have become we are now in a time where these corporations are not only becoming countries, but they are soon to become empires. They will become ancient, dynastic families that will eventually grow into becoming full-on countries. And I know it's very sort of big and apocalyptic and crazy. And I'm sorry if this was a sort of rambling conversation on all of this, but that's where I see this moving to. That's where again, when we're so complacent, when we don't want to look at what is essentially going on, it's unfolding. Who gives a fuck if Donald Trump said, oh, we're not going to do TPP? He's just going to come up with something else. You really honestly think that this man, has your best interest at heart? You're crazy, because he is running the country like a business. He is making the U.S. more into a nationalist corporation, while the corporations are continuing to grow into countries, into sovereign nations, which are not, you think that countries are basically not beholden to war crimes laws. If you have power, you know, if you're England or France, the U.S. or Germany, and then other certain countries, you're not really, you're exempt from war crimes and things. Obviously, you know, if you're from Africa, they're virtually all those people are war criminals. Same with the Middle East and some other places. But when countries are able to get away with that, right? Corporations, multiply that by 10. They get away with whatever the fuck they want to. Okay? They are completely above the law, and they will continue to rise to that level. And that is happening more and more and more. I mean, it's shocking, I think, how fast this is happening. But anyway, we are now finally at the break. So thank you all for joining me. I will be coming to you next week. I might have to be a repeat episode. I'm not sure exactly, but I will let you know later on in the week. And of course, let me know if you want to get a copy of the American Journal of Economics and Sociology. But thank you all for joining me, and stick here with American Freedom Radio.
News and information you can trust. This is American Freedom Radio. Freedom, freedom, American Freedom Radio. Radio. American Freedom Radio.
And I hope people support American Freedom Radio. And I hope people vote with their dollars and really understand the value of having American Freedom Radio. Because that's my family. If you love me at all, Jack Blood, support American Freedom Radio. Like, my family has literally disowned me in American Freedom Radio. Danny and Don and those guys, those are my actual family. So please, please support these guys, because they have all the technology, they have all these great things that they're gonna do, but obviously they can't do it all by themselves. So not only would I like to see you support them, I'd like to see you retweet them and repost them and really get involved and get on the bandwagon, so to speak, on doing that do-it-yourself promotion, because they're a do-it-yourself radio network, and we just need that so much.
Nutritious food is real body armor. It builds muscle, burns fat, improves digestion, and feeds the entire body the nutrients it needs. Did you know the U.S. government banned the hemp plant from growing in the United States and classified it as a Schedule I drug to hide it behind the marijuana plant? People have been confused about this plant for over 80 years, and many still don't know what hemp is. So now you know hemp is not marijuana, and marijuana is not hemp. They are different varieties of the same species. HempUSA.org wants the world to know these basic facts and to help people understand that hemp protein powder is the best-kept health secret you need to know about. Remember, hemp protein powder contains 53% protein, is gluten-free, anti-inflammatory, non-GMO, and is loaded with nutrients. Call 888-910-4367, 888-910-4367, and see what our powder, seeds, and oil can do for you. Only at HempUSA.org.
We all know that they're not telling us the truth. So stand up for your rights, demand the real medicine, and your right to use it and grow it. This is Rick Sensen, and you're listening to American Freedom Radio.
The world is like a ride at an amusement park, and when you choose to go on it, you think it's real, because that's how powerful our minds are. And the ride goes up and down and round and round. It has thrills and chills, and it's very brightly colored, and it's very loud, and it's fun for a while. Some people have been on the ride for a long time, and they begin to question, is this real or is this just a ride? And other people have remembered, and they come back to us and they say, hey, don't worry, don't be afraid, ever, because this is just a ride. And we kill those people. The eyes of fear want you to put bigger locks on your door, buy guns, close yourself off. The eyes of love instead see all of us as one. Here's what we can do to change the world right now to a better ride. Take all that money we spend on weapons and defense each year and instead spend it feeding, clothing, and educating the poor of the world, which it would many times over, not one human being excluded, and we can explore space together, both inner and outer, forever in peace.
You're listening to AmericanFreedomRadio.com, the network who perseveres in delivering intelligent debate, constructive dialogue with true independence. The freedom to broadcast the truth is not free at all. So what is American Freedom Radio worth to you? The empowering information with fun, honest and pure integrity behind it provides an example to follow. Friendships to flourish with the moral altruism that pulls no punches. The hosts sacrifice and show remarkable discipline in their duty to deliver quality radio and service to the community with strength, wisdom and loyalty. The founders of AFR wish to thank you personally for sharing your views and insights to make the best radio and alternative media. Now it's time for you to give something back and play a vital role in the future of America. Be as generous with us as we've been with you. Click on the donate banner at AmericanFreedomRadio.com or volunteer by emailing AmericanFreedomRadio@ymail.com. Vaccines, psychotropic drugs, and artillery batteries not included.
No rules, no rules, no taboo topics, no taboo topics, no fear of doom, no fear of doom. We are American Freedom Radio, American Freedom Radio.